from Pacifica. This is Democracy Now!
Okay, this man, I like this guy.
I walk on white plains. Amen. Okay. We problem in this country. It's called Muslims. We know our current president is one. Right. You know he's not even an American.
We need this first question. This is the man. First question.
But anyway, we have training camps growing where they want to kill us. Mm-hmm. That's my question. When can we get rid of them?
We're going to be...
After three straight victories, frontrunner Donald Trump heads into tonight's final Republican debate ahead of next week's Super Tuesday primary. We'll look at a new report by the Southern Poverty Law Center called The Year in Hate and Extremism. Its cover features Donald Trump in front of a microphone. Then, as the government continues to take a bite out of Apple, Apple CEO Tim Cook says the FBI's request to unlock the iPhone of one of the San Bernardino shooters is the software equivalent of cancer.
This case is not about my phone. This case is about the future. What is at stake here is, can the government compel Apple to write software that we believe would make hundreds of millions of customers vulnerable around the world, including the U.S.?
We'll speak with former CIA agent Barry Eisler, who worked in covert operations, now writes thrillers. Then, in an exclusive interview, we speak with Anna Therese Day, one of four U.S. journalists who were detained by the U.S.-backed Gulf state of Bahrain and released Sunday after an international outcry. She and her camera crew were in Bahrain during protests marking the anniversary of the kingdom's February 2011 uprising.
Of course, we're delighted and relieved and grateful to be out of Bahraini custody, but it couldn't be a more stark reminder of the privileges we have operating as Western journalists in these countries while our Bahraini colleagues continue to rot in Bahraini jails.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least seven people have died as more than 50 tornadoes swept across parts of the South and Eastern United States over the last 2 days. The extreme weather has destroyed hundreds of homes and forced the closure of schools and government offices. At least four people have died in Virginia, including a two-year-old boy. Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe has declared a state of emergency. Scientists have linked an increase in the intensity and deadlines of tornadoes to climate change. New government documents show the number of private contractors hired by the Pentagon in Iraq has increased eightfold over the past year. There are currently more than 2,000 private contractors working for the Pentagon in Iraq, up from only 250 contractors last year. This comes as the Pentagon has also increased the number of U.S. troops in Iraq, up to 3,700 soldiers. A new report by two Israeli human rights groups accuses the Israeli Shin Bet Security Agency of abusing dozens of Palestinian prisoners at the Shikma interrogation facility. The report, issued by the groups B'Tselem and Hamoked, says Palestinian prisoners are exposed to extreme heat or cold, deprived of sleep, and denied sufficient food. It concludes, quote, the combination of conditions both in and outside the interrogation room constitutes abuse and inhuman, degrading treatment, at times even amounting to torture. This comes as two U.S.-based groups have taken out a full-page ad in the Los Angeles Times urging Oscar nominees to skip a trip to Israel, which is being offered as part of an awards gift bag. The gift bag is being handed out by a marketing company and is not affiliated with the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Organizers say they're calling on Oscar-nominated directors and actors to skip the 10-day free trip because of Israel's continued occupation of Palestinian territories. The trip is partially funded by the Israeli government. In news from the campaign trail, the five remaining Republican presidential candidates—real estate billionaire Donald Trump, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, neurosurgeon Ben Carson and Ohio Governor John Kasich—will face off in Houston for the last debate before Super Tuesday tonight. Donald Trump has won three of the four primaries and caucuses to date. On Tuesday, 11 states and the territory American Samoa will hold primary contests. Meanwhile, a Black Lives Matter activist interrupted presidential candidate Hillary Clinton during a private fundraiser Wednesday night in Charleston, South Carolina. During the event, Ashley Williams held a banner reading, quote, "We have to bring them to heel." a reference to controversial statements Clinton made in 1996 about some youth whom she called super predators. Williams then confronted Clinton, saying, quote, I am not a super predator.
I'm not a super predator, Hillary Clinton.
Okay, fine, we'll talk
about
it.
Can you apologize to black people for mass incarceration?
Well, can I talk and then maybe you can listen to what I say? Okay, fine. Thank you very much. There's a lot of issues in this campaign.
I know that you called black youth super predators in 1994. Please explain to the record. Explain it to us. You owe black people an apology.
Well,
excuse us. That's an inappropriate
thing. You will. You're the first person to ask me, and I'm happy to address it, but you are the first person to ask me here. Okay, back to the issues.
That was Black Lives Matter activist Ashley Williams confronting Hillary Clinton at a private fundraiser Wednesday night. She was then escorted away. Williams says a friend contributed $500 so she could attend the private fundraiser. President Obama is reportedly considering Nevada Republican Governor, former federal judge Brian Sandoval, as a potential Supreme Court nominee following the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. This comes as Republicans continue to say they will not consider any nominations put forward by President Obama. The Turkish government has halted the construction of a new copper mine amidst massive protests by residents who fear the mine would destroy the local environment. Last week, protesters blocked a road to prevent construction trucks from accessing the mine site. On Wednesday, Turkey's prime minister said the construction of the mine was on hold pending a court decision. A new United Nations report says all sides in the Libyan conflict are likely guilty of war crimes, including torture, rape and the execution of prisoners. This comes as the Italian government has quietly begun allowing the U.S. military to use an air base in Sicily to launch drones for U.S. military operations in Libya and across North Africa. U.S. officials say the use of the base is only for defensive operations, although the U.S. is seeking permission to also use the base for offensive operations, such as the strike last Friday, which killed about 50 people. Including two Serbian hostages. Bolivian President Evo Morales has acknowledged defeat in a referendum that would have allowed him a fourth term. Morales's current term ends in 2020. The referendum would have allowed him to remain in power until 2025. On Wednesday, resident Oscar Solis celebrated the results of the referendum.
We're very happy for this day of victory. We thank the Bolivian people because we have said no to corruption, no to the traffic of influences, no to the lies. The people don't want our state political constitution to change. The people want new leaders.
In Mexico, President Enrique Peña Nieto has visited the city of Iguala for the first time since 43 students disappeared from the city after being attacked by local police more than a year ago. During the visit, President Peña Nieto avoided meeting with the families of the disappeared students and made only passing reference to the students during a military ceremony Wednesday. The visit comes only days after a team of independent investigators held a news conference criticizing the Mexican government for continuing to block their inquiry into the students' disappearance. Investigator Claudia Paz y Paz said the team was looking into the link between the disappearance and drug trafficking routes between Iguala and Chicago.
For us, it is fundamental to deepen the line of investigation of the transfer of heroin from Iguala to Chicago. It is advanced, but we believe that it is necessary to continue with all the tasks that we have proposed within this line to clarify the events.
Claudia Paz y Paz is the former Attorney General of Guatemala. And in South Korea, organizers held a, quote, ghost rally to protest crackdowns on the right to assembly. On Wednesday, members of Amnesty International Korea projected holographic images of protesters holding signs and carrying flowers onto a screen in a public square in central Seoul. It was the first holographic protest in South Korea. Police are reportedly trying to decide whether the ghost rally violated the law, and if so, who to punish. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Tonight, four Republican presidential contenders will face off in Houston during the final debate ahead of next week's Super Tuesday primary, when delegates in Texas and 10 other states, along with American Samoa, will be at stake. This comes as billionaire businessman Donald Trump easily won the Nevada caucus Tuesday night, capturing 46% of the vote in his third consecutive victory. Trump thanked supporters during a victory speech in Nevada.
So we won the evangelicals. We won with young. We won with old. We won with highly educated. We won with poorly educated. I love the poorly educated. We're the smartest people. We're the most loyal people. And you know what I really am happy about? Because I've been saying it for a long time. 46% with the Hispanics. 46%. Number one with Hispanics. I'm really happy about that. So...
Donald Trump will be one of five candidates who face off in tonight's debate. Well, Donald Trump is featured in a new report just published by the Southern Poverty Law Center called The Year in Hate and Extremism. Its cover includes an image of Trump in front of a microphone. The report details how the number of hate groups rose 14% last year, bringing the total number of hate groups in the U.S. to nearly 900. It found the number of Ku Klux Klan groups more than doubled. It also documented 34 anti-Muslim hate groups and 48 anti-LGBTQ hate groups.
The Southern Poverty Law Center points to the presidential election cycle as one of the primary reasons for the rising number of hate groups across the U.S., saying last year was marked by a level of hate speech in mainstream politics not seen in decades. It notes, quote, Donald Trump's demonizing statements about Latinos and Muslims have electrified the radical right, leading to glowing endorsements from the white nationalist leaders such as Jared Taylor and former Klansman David Duke. White supremacist forums are awash with electoral joy, having dubbed Trump their glorious leader. The Investigation Discovery Network will premiere a series titled Hate in America, based on the work of the Southern Poverty Law Center this Monday, February 29th. Well, for more, we're joined by the center's president, Richard Cohen. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you for the first time in our studio.
Thank you, Amy.
On our 20th anniversary.
Perfect.
So, talk about this report, the picture right here, The Year in Hate and Extremism, with the major face on the cover, Donald Trump, in front of a microphone.
I'm not sure that Mr. Trump would object to being center stage. He never seems to. And it's been an unusual time. You know, usually in the white supremacist world, the attitude is a pox on both their homes. You know, the system is incredibly corrupt. This time, you know, as you said, people are very, very excited about Trump. They call him the glorious leader. And it's all about the immigration issue. People like Jared Taylor.
And explain who Jared Taylor is.
Jared Taylor is a longtime white nationalist. Most recently, he came into the public mind because he served as the spokesperson for the Council of Conservative Citizens. That was the hate group whose Kool-Aid Dylann Roof drank when he was radicalized. So, you know, he's been a real fixture on the white supremacist scene and a very influential one.
So could you talk about some of the main findings of the report?
Sure. Well, first, you know, we saw an increase in the number of hate groups in the country, going from about 800 to 900. We also saw a similar increase of 14% to about 1,000 of these radical anti-government groups, the people who believe that, you know, there are FEMA camps that are awaiting us, that people are trying to make us into the new world order. Secondly, we saw a really incredible level of violence last year. What was the massacre in Charleston, most well-known, but really, you know, scores of events, some quite deadly. And lastly, of course, the mainstreaming of hate in the political campaign and by pundits on the airwaves.
What about what about the media's role, Richard?
I mean, the media amplifies the hate that's out there. They give, you know, every time Donald Trump, you know, starts talking about rapists and, you know, from Mexico and whatnot, it's blasted all over the air. It coarsens, you know, kind of our society. It makes it almost acceptable to talk that way.
And you say in the report that the radical right has shifted its principal base to the internet. Why is that important?
Well, you know, it used to be the case that if you wanted to get your fill of hate, you'd go to a Klan rally or cross-burning. Nowadays, you can do it from your home. and you have it's easier, and you have the benefit of anonymity. And we've seen during President Obama's administration a tremendous increase in the number of persons who are online haters. Stormfront, which is the most important online forum for hate members, has grown by 100% since Obama has been in office. These are 300,000 people who don't just visit, millions visit, but 300,000 people who have signed up and, you know, for posting privileges so they can, you know, spew their venom daily.
You talk about terrorist attacks and radical plots proliferating.
Yes.
We're not talking about ISIS. So explain exactly what we're talking about.
Well, you know, we did a report showed that there was a terrorist attack or a domestic incident, domestic terrorism, about once every 34 days over the last 5 years. Some of these attacks, of course, are, you know, kind of well-known, you know, like the massacre in Charleston.
At the Emanuel Church.
Right. The killings in the Planned Parenthood. But I just think people don't get a sense of,
you know, Colorado Springs.
Yeah, how common these things are.
Well, some have criticized the methodology used in the SPLC report. Vanderbilt University political science professor Carol Swain has argued that the SPLC is too all-encompassing, saying they, quote, paint with a very broad brush, and in the process they tend to sweep up people that are politically conservative. I think they do it in a very harmful way, and they abuse their power as an organization. She goes on to say, quote, these are individuals that are Christian conservatives. They're just traditional conservatives, but because of their position on LGBT issues, the Southern Poverty Law Center finds ways to malign these individuals or their organizations. Richard Cohen, your response to this criticism.
Well, you know, our methodology is well known. We call groups hate groups when they vilify entire groups of people because of their immutable characteristics. You know, Focus on the Family is a very conservative Christian organization, and we certainly don't call them a hate group. But we would call groups that spread demonizing lies about the LGBT community, lies such as, you know, pedophilia is, you know, a problem for the gay community, or the American Family Association saying that, you know, gay people brought us the Holocaust and black people rut like rabbits. I think that you can call yourself the American Family Association, you can wrap yourself in the Bible, but when you say things like that, I think you deserve the moniker of a hate group.
Well, you also say that the report says that there's been a 14, which we talked about, 14% increase in hate groups in 2015. But the report also indicates that that's probably an underestimation.
Yeah.
Could you explain?
Well, you know, our methods of detecting hate groups, you know, aren't foolproof, and we certainly, there's obvious an undercount. It's also, it doesn't take into account, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people who aren't formally affiliated with hate groups, but, you know, have hate in their hearts. It's just one indicator of the level of rage, the level of vitriol that exists in the country.
Last year, Donald Trump faced criticism after a town hall in New Hampshire when, during the Q&A, one of his supporters stood up and said President Obama's a Muslim and not even an American, and asked when the United States could get rid of Muslims.
Okay, this man, I like this guy.
I walk on white plains. Amen. Okay. We have a problem in this country. It's called Muslims. We know our current president is one.
Right.
You know he's not even an American.
We need this
birth
question.
Certificate,
this is
man.
The first question.
But anyway, we have training camps growing where they want to kill us.
Mm-hmm.
That's my question. When can we get rid of them?
We're going to be looking at a lot of different things. And, you know, a lot of people are saying that, and a lot of people are saying that bad things are happening out there. We're going to be looking at that and plenty of other things.
Your response to what Donald Trump said in this town hall meeting, Richard Cohen?
Well, I'm not surprised by the supporter who stood up. Over 60% of the people who support Trump believe that President Obama is a secret Muslim and wasn't born in this country. So, you know, none of that surprises me. you know, what we're hearing on the campaign trail, what is leading to the increase in the number of hate groups in our country, is the changing demographics of our country. It's changing rapidly, and, you know, I think, you know, many white people feel like the tide is turning against them. And so we have a reaction to that. We see the reaction in the vilification of Muslims. We see the reaction to it in the vilification of kind of Hispanics. You know, a generation ago, it was the Southern strategy. Now, you know, it's a, different people are targeted.
How does Oregon fit into this, the standoff that was just finished with the death of the spokesperson and the others in jail?
Well, I think what really fits into it is what happened on Clive and Bundy's ranch. You know, he refuses to pay his grazing fees, doesn't pay his fines.
This is in Nevada.
Yeah, they point guns at federal officials, and nothing happens. And so, as a result, the anti-government patriot organization group, you know, grows tremendously and are emboldened. Then they show up in Oregon and take over that that compound. And, of course, they eventually arrested Clive and Bundy, but they could have arrested him the day after the standoff in Nevada. And I think it was the failure of the federal officials to move more quickly originally that led to the explosion in anti-government groups and led to the situation in Oregon.
Well, what are some of the other factors? Because the report talks about how many Americans are now anti-government.
Yes.
What do you think accounts for this growth in suspicion of the government, in addition to what you pointed out? Do you think that having the first, for example, African-American president has contributed to that?
I think that's absolutely right. We've seen this tremendous increase in the number of anti-government groups during President Obama's tenure. You know, there was a big increase during the time of Bill Clinton. Then it went down during George Bush's presidency, and now it shot up again under President Obama's tenure. And there's also, you know, this changing demographics makes people less trustful of the efficacy of collective action. It's kind of a well-known sociological fact. And, of course, the vehicle of collective action in our country, perhaps the most important vehicle, is the government itself. So people have lost confidence in institutions.
And the collapse of the economy for many.
Absolutely.
Not for all.
You know, we kind of white working-class people, you know, their prospects aren't nearly as good as they were a generation ago. And so there's a tremendous amount of angst and anger in the country as
a
result.
On Monday, Investigation Discovery will air a new documentary series called Hate in America, Klan on Trial, recounting the story of Michael Donald, the victim of brutal Klan violence in Mobile, Alabama, in the early 80s. The SPLC took the case and helped bring down the United Klans of America. This is a trailer for the series.
When hatred leads to murder.
Why did they do all that?
He dies just because of the color of his skin.
Something needs to be done.
I would like to bring the United Klan to justice.
ID presents the heroes who overcame the hate.
She was the face, the woman that beat the Klan.
And found a way to fight for justice.
This is bigger than just our family.
Hate in America, the Klan on Trial, all new special.
The Klan on Trial. As we wrap up, Richard Cohen, what are you hoping will come out of the series that you're doing?
You know, we're trying to shine a light on the reality of hate in America. So, you know, people don't turn their backs, people don't become apathetic, and people decide or try to build bridges, you know, across the racial divide, across the ethnic divide. We're a better country than what Donald Trump says. You know, what makes America great is not building walls, it's building bridges.
When Donald Trump retweets a white supremacist, what is the problem with that when he says, I don't know their background, I just liked something they said?
Well, it's wild. You know, one of the things he retweeted was the hashtag was white genocide. I don't know how you can claim ignorance when the hashtag is white genocide. It's kind of a well-known meme in the white supremacist world having to do with the idea that white people under attack. People like Dylan Roof and other killers, you know, have bought into that and are striking out. It's crazy to say he didn't know what that meant.
Well, Richard Cohen, I want to thank you for being with us. President of the Southern Poverty Law Center just released its annual report, The Year in Hate and Extremism. The cover featuring Donald Trump in front of a microphone. The ID Network, Investigation Discovery, will be premiering a series titled Hate in America, based on the work of the Southern Poverty Law Center. The first of the series begins Monday, February 29th at 8 p.m. Eastern. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, The FBI tries to take a bite out of Apple. We'll talk with a former covert CIA operative who's now a thriller writer. His latest book is The God's Eye View. New York Times bestselling author Barry Eisler will join us. Stay with us.
10,000 miles away from home, and I don't even know my name. 10,000 miles away. And I don't even know my name. I'd rather have your love, baby, than have all the wealth and fame. Gonna be a free man in the morning. Oh, once I had a gal with a big fat nagging mouth. She says, honey, let's go north. So I headed for the south. Says, don't know if I'm going to Paducah or KC. Any road that's open makes a free man of me. Gonna be a free man. Oh, once I had a straw boss, he was mean and tough. He sweated me so long, I says, Captain, that's enough. So I hit him with my shovel, hey, he fell like a tree. Oh, feet keep on a running, make a free man of me. Gonna be a free man in the morning.
Free Man in the Morning, performed by Andy Griffith from the film A Face in the Crowd. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to the ongoing dispute over privacy and encryption between the FBI and the computer giant Apple. In an interview last night on ABC, Apple CEO Tim Cook explained why his company is resisting a court order to help unlock the iPhone of one of San Bernardino attackers. In December, Sayed Rizwan Farooq and his wife killed 14 people and injured 22 others. The two attackers were killed in a shootout with police. Cook said what the U.S. government was asking Apple to do was the, quote, software equivalent of cancer.
This case is not about one phone. This case is about the future. What is at stake here is, can the government compel Apple to write software that we believe would make hundreds of millions of customers vulnerable around the world, including the U.S., the only way we know, would be to write a piece of software that we view as sort of the software equivalent of cancer. We think it's bad news to write. We would never write it. We have never written it. And that is what is at stake here.
The FBI says Apple's overstating the security risk to its devices and argues the litigation's limited. In an open letter earlier this week, FBI Director James Comey wrote, quote, the particular legal issue is actually quite narrow. We don't want to break anyone's encryption or set a master key loose on the land, he said. Apple phone systems have a function that automatically erases the access key and renders the phone permanently inaccessible after 10 failed attempts. To talk more about the case, we're joined by Barry Eisler, who has written about government surveillance in fictional form, but he's also a former CIA agent. Eisler is the author of a number of books, most recently, The God's Eye View. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you, Amy.
So let's talk about what the government is doing and the pushback of Apple.
Yeah, I like Tim Cook's metaphor. It's nice to see someone hitting back linguistically this way. You would expect the FBI to say what it's saying. It's only about one phone. This is the kind of thing the government always says. And I'm reminded of the time the CIA acknowledged that it had made two torture tapes. 15 months later, it acknowledged that it was, in fact, 92. In this case, the government said this is only going to be about one phone, and it took them only a day to say, did we say one phone? Actually, we're talking about 12. If you talk to any encryption or security expert anywhere, they'll all tell you that what the FBI is asking for is impossible. You can't create a backdoor for one phone without making all phones vulnerable. So that's one important issue here. But there's another one that I think is not adequately understood. As Julian Sanchez, a guy I follow pretty closely because he knows a lot about these things, works with the Cato Institute, put it, this isn't just about encryption, it's about conscription. And I wish people would understand this a little bit better. It's unprecedented for the government to be telling a private company what products it can create, what features it has to include in those products. As Tim Cook pointed out, where does this stop? What if the government said we want to have a feature on the iPhone that enables the FBI to turn on the iPhone camera, to turn on the iPhone microphone anytime we want? Would that also be okay? So I hope this isn't going to happen. It's sort of odd to have to be championing the world's richest corporation in its fight with the government.
I mean, they're asking the Apple to write a program which would then create a backdoor.
Exactly. And it won't be unique to this one phone. It would be something that the government could use against any phone. And even if you think that the U.S. government, it's okay for the government to be able to break the encryption of anybody's phone, even if you trust the U.S. government and think the U.S. government has never lied to anyone, never abused its powers, even if you believe anything like that, what backdoors accessible to the U.S. government would also be accessible to whatever is the American enemy du jour, could be the Chinese government, Russia, Iran, and of course, not just to state actors, but also to criminal groups and hackers. A vulnerability in a phone is not accessible to just one actor.
But he killed 14 people, he and his wife, and they just want access to see if there's other plans. I mean, who knows what would be.
So this is another thing the government is typically good at. It tries to find the most attractive fact pattern it can to use as the thin edge of a wedge that it can then use in other less obvious fact patterns. And I see this again and again. People don't remember that well now, but Jose Padilla, I'm sure you guys remember, the so-called dirty bomber. I mean, Jose Padilla was accused of trying to create a radiological bomb and detonated in Chicago, and a whole lot of people were going to die. And so to keep us safe from that kind of thing, the government arrested him, held him on a Navy ship, offshored him. No due process, no charges, no trial, no access to a lawyer. It was unprecedented. But they were careful to choose what for them was an attractive fact pattern before doing something so unprecedented. They picked a scary-looking guy and accused him of doing scary things. And people didn't protest the way they would have if they had chosen someone a little bit different. So it's the same thing here. They're not doing this in the name of, I don't know, preventing someone from shoplifting or something like that. They've chosen a very attractive fact pattern so that they can say the talking points that you were just parroting, which is like, come on, this is just to keep us safe from the really scary people who want to kill us all in our beds and who indeed did kill a lot of people in San Bernardino.
So to what extent do you think that accounts for public opinion? Because a recent Pew Center poll found that 51% of Americans think Apple should comply with the FBI and unlock the iPhone of one of the perpetrators of the attacks, and only 38% that said that the FBI should not, and the rest had no opinion.
Yeah, which is not actually, which is not a bad response to anyone who thinks that Apple is doing this as some sort of publicity stunt. I mean, for the moment anyway, more people think that Apple should comply than think that it shouldn't. I think the fact that so many people, actually that 38%, think it's a really bad idea for Apple to be forced to do this is in part a tribute to the educational value of the Snowden revelations and all the journalism that's been built on them. Because I'm pretty sure, can't really conduct this experiment, but I'm pretty sure that if it hadn't been for Snowden's revelations, the public would be focusing entirely on the keep us safe from the terrorists aspect of this whole thing and not on the, but this is going to destroy privacy.
Interestingly, Apple has made the iCloud available. It's not like they haven't done that. I mean, there have been many requests of these different phone manufacturers to get access to the iCloud.
Right.
And, I mean, the government can't just get access to it. They have to get permission. So they're making a distinction between the actual physical phone.
Right.
Apparently, they turned off the iCloud at some point. So it's what's remained on that phone since the point they turned it off.
Right. So the idea here is that some of your data is not accessible even by the company that created the product. It's on your local device, and no one else should have access to it. but you. Apple has, in fact, complied with the government in the government's request to turn over data to which it has access. Maybe people might like that. They might not like it. My own feeling is, look, as long as it's pursuant to a warrant and it's not secret and it's out in the open, I can live with it. But the notion that now Apple is going to crack encryption that its users have come to rely on to keep their data private is an entirely new thing.
Well, I want to turn to comments made by Bill Gates, the co-founder of Microsoft. He was asked about the ongoing dispute between Apple and the FBI and said it was important to strike a balance between privacy and government access. Gates was speaking to Bloomberg.
The extreme view that the government always gets everything, nobody supports that. Having the government be blind, people don't support that. I do believe that with the right safeguards, there are cases where the government, on our behalf, like stopping terrorism, which could get worse in the future, that is valuable. But striking that balance, clearly the government's taken information historically and used it in ways that we didn't expect, going all the way back, say, to the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover. So I'm hoping now we can have the discussion. I do believe there are sets of safeguards where the government shouldn't have to be completely blind.
That was Bill Gates speaking to Bloomberg News. Your response?
It's interesting. He's so close to an epiphany. He talks about J. Edgar Hoover. Maybe he knows about COINTELPRO. He acknowledges that the government has abused powers that it's been given in the past. And so you think he's going in a certain direction with this. And then he just comes up with this platitude, which is we have to strike a balance. Like, who doesn't think that we shouldn't strike a balance? It's just meaningless. There's no one who would say, I don't think we need a balance. I think it's just one or the other. So I don't know. Maybe it's not a coincidence that Microsoft is a fading technology company and Apple is a premier one.
Microsoft has said in the past that 80 tech companies have cooperated. Well, I mean, WikiLeaks has said that 80 tech companies in the past have cooperated with the NSA, the National Security Agency, including Microsoft.
Yeah, so much of the Snowden's revelations were about this very thing. And the fact that that the public knows about corporate cooperation with the government now is in part, I think, what has emboldened Apple to push back. Because, again, if we didn't know about these things, I would expect that Apple would be quietly cooperating. There'd be no cost to their doing so. But they realize now that there's a significant constituency among their customers that wants robust privacy features in Apple products. And to please those customers, Apple realizes that in this public battle with the FBI, it can't just roll over and serve the FBI. Otherwise, it might turn into the next Microsoft.
Well, let's turn to NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. In a 2013 interview with The Guardian, just after his identity was revealed, Snowden explained why he risked his career to leak the documents.
I think that the public is owed an explanation of the motivations behind the people who make these disclosures that are outside of the democratic model. When you are subverting the power of government, that's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy. And if you do that in secret consistently, you know, as the government does when it wants to benefit from a secret action that it took, it'll kind of give its officials a mandate to go, hey, you know, tell the press about this thing and that thing, so the public is on our side. But they rarely, if ever, do that when an abuse occurs. That falls to individual citizens, but they're typically maligned. You know, it becomes a thing of these people are against the country, they're against the government, but I'm not. I'm no different from anybody else. I don't have special skills. I'm just another guy who sits there day to day in the office, watches what's happening, and goes, this is something that's not our place to decide. The public needs to decide whether these programs and policies are right or wrong. And I'm willing to go on the record to defend the authenticity of them and say, I didn't change these. I didn't modify the story. This is the truth. This is what's happening. You should decide whether we need to be doing this.
That was NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden speaking in 2013. So, Barry Eisler, you begin your book with Edward Snowden. Could you talk about that decision to talk about Edward Snowden?
Sure.
And also, the title of your book is The God's Eye View.
Yeah. So, like all my fiction, but especially so in this case, it's grounded in things that are actually happening in the world. And when I first had the idea for this book, by the way, I had a notion for a pretty far-reaching surveillance program, and I thought it would make the good basis a good basis for a novel. My concern was that what I had in mind was going to be too far-reaching, and because my brand has a lot to do with realism, I thought people might say, come on, Barry, the government's not really doing all that. And while I was working on my previous book, but just kind of thinking about this next one, I was actually in Tokyo doing research. June 2013 is when Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras first started breaking stories with The Guardian based on Snowden's revelations. And I was immediately electrified, and I realized, oh, my God, I was not going nearly far enough in what I had imagined.
Now, I mean, what's interesting is you're a fiction writer here.
Right.
But your background is CIA, yeah. In covert operations.
Right.
So you begin this book with Poitras and Greenwald meeting with Snowden in Hong Kong, complete catastrophe for the intelligence agency here.
Right.
They're woken up in the middle of the night. What do we do? And the discussion of just taking them all out,
right,
including Ewan McCaskill, who is from The Guardian, who was with them.
Right.
Taking them out.
Yeah.
But you do have a background in reality, which
right.
is in covert operations.
Yeah. So if you're asking me, have I ever heard the government give an order to kill a journalist, the answer is no. But I do know that increasingly the government equates journalism with terrorism, I mean, explicitly. And if we're using certain tools and tactics against terrorists, then it makes sense those things are going to migrate to other enemies of the state, right? In fact, I think that when you think about terrorist groups like ISIS and then power centers in countries like America, a group like ISIS is nothing but ISIS, is nothing but upside to any political establishment figure who wants to increase his or her budget or up fear among the public so that the politician can gain more power. It means more profits for corporations involved in the war machine. Really, nothing but upside. But dissident groups, student groups, anti-war groups, civil rights activists represent a lot of downside. And this is, and journalists most of all who are relying on whistleblowers and real leaks to carry out their journalism. So when I imagined how is the government going to respond to this kind of thing, I'm thinking, well, how does the government respond to what sort of tools has it developed and has it deployed against the ostensible enemies of the government, and how is it going to deploy them against real enemies
like
journalists?
How are you deployed in the CIA?
I didn't do very much with the CIA, and whenever I say that, people are like, yeah, right. It's like when a presidential candidate says, you know, I have no intention of running for president. People are like, oh, come on, man. You know, when are you really going to? I was there for barely 3 years. It was mostly training. It was a super interesting experience. I'm glad I had it, and it definitely informs everything I write about and hopefully makes the sort of spycraft counter surveillance, all sorts of tradecraft and the mentality of spies, that sort of thing that I depict in my novels. Hopefully the experience I had with the CIA makes all that as realistic as possible, but I wish I could say on Democracy Now! That I was involved in numerous coups and assassinations. It would be a really cool segment we're doing, but alas, it was mostly training.
But one of the things that you've said that you learned at the CIA was that sometimes it pays to cover up the commission of a serious crime
yeah.
by confessing to a lesser one.
Yes. And it's funny how often I see that sort of thing played out in national headlines. There are things they say at the CIA that are said partly in jest, but only partly. So another one is, it is better to seek forgiveness than ask permission. And I see the government doing this sort of thing constantly. And, so some of these things you really do. Another one is deny everything, admit nothing, make counter-accusations. Keep that one in mind. You will see the government doing—you'll see politicians doing it all the time.
So the God's eye view, what is it?
Well, I don't want to give away any spoilers, but God's eye is a program of far-reaching surveillance in the book. And
this is a fiction book?
Well, I have an 18-page bibliography at the end of the book because I want people to know that if you don't follow these things closely, you might have that reaction I was talking about earlier, which is you'll read the book and say, well, that was a fun, entertaining thriller, but come on, can the government really do these things? Is it really doing these things? And reviews thus far have been really gratifying for me because people do respond to the book the way I would hope they would respond to fiction. They enjoy it. It's gripping. They're on the edge of their seats. And then they say, and then I came to the bibliography and I realized, oh, my God, all these things are real. They are real. I've speculated a little bit about how how a program like God's Eye would be deployed. But all the technologies I describe in the book, and there are some that will make your hair stand up, they're real and right. They're actually deployed. Can you hack into a car? Can you turn a microphone on, not just on a phone, but on all these personal assistant devices that are getting deployed in people's homes? Baby cameras, closed circuit television all over the... heart devices, pacemakers, these sorts of things. In my very first book, which I started writing in 1993, it was published in 2002, A Clean Kill in Tokyo, my half-American, half-Japanese assassin, John Rain, shorted out a guy's pacemaker wirelessly. And at the time, there was no Bluetooth. It was all infrared. I was using infrared, but it was wireless. And I checked with a Harvard cardiac, a pacemaker specialist guy I lived with in college, actually. I said, could you really do this? And he's like, well, I guess so. Why would you want to? So people always ask me at the time. Now they know I'm a novelist. Anyway, it turns out you can absolutely do this, so much so that Dick Cheney, in his memoirs, acknowledged that he had his heart doctor turn off the wireless feature on his pacemaker because of concerns that... that somebody might try to turn it off. I was going to say terrorists, but actually probably there are a lot of people who probably at one time or another considered, you know, pressing the button on that.
Well, very quickly before we conclude, I want to ask you about something you said earlier, that the government increasingly equates journalism with terrorism. Yeah. How did you learn that?
Just by observing. I remember when David Miranda was detained at Heathrow. I guess this was about 2 years ago.
Glenn Greenwald's partner.
Right. And I wondered, why is the government doing this? I mean, they must know. It's not like he's got the only copy of whatever it is they're looking for. So why do something like that? And I realized, look, this is basically a deny and disrupt operation. I mean, why does the government want terrorists to know that it's into their cell phones, that it can track you by your cell phone use and probably put in a drone strike based on that information? In fact, we know that sort of thing goes on, whether it's a so-called signature strike where they don't know your identity or where they do. Why do they do that? Is it to make terrorists unable to communicate? No, it won't have that effect. It's to make it more difficult for them to communicate, to make plotting whatever the terrorists are trying to plot slower and harder and that's why the government does these things. So I thought, why detain this guy?
Well, it's under the Terrorism Act.
Yeah, I know. So this is another, thank you. That is like the quintessential example of like, oh, wow, so journalists really are literally terrorists, in this case to the UK government, but in cooperation with the American government. So they're not going to stop journalists from communicating by this, but it's a kind of signal. They know that for the most sensitive things that journalists are working on, journalists don't trust their cell phones and they're using human couriers. So what do? You let them know even human couriers are not going to be safe for you. Deny and disrupt.
I wanted to end by asking you a question that our colleague Jeremy Scahill asked you last night in a Q&A that you had here in New York. And it's about something that the Clinton campaign is trying to make a big deal of, something Bernie Sanders said decades ago, calling the CIA a dangerous institution that has got to go. He said this in 1974. Now, he is not saying that today. These days, he talks about more oversight for the agency.
Right.
But as a former person in covert operations at the CIA, do you share his view more, the one he expresses today, more oversight, or the one he expressed 40 years ago, do away with the CIA?
Yeah, I would say first that people need to understand Sanders is not an outlier in calling for the abolishment of the CIA. President Truman said he'd get rid of the agency. John F. Kennedy famously said he would shatter the organization into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. This is following the Bay of Pigs. A lot. Daniel Moynihan said, oh, my God, we're not getting our money's worth. This thing is doing more harm than good. Yeah, Senator, former Senator Moynihan. So there have been a lot of prominent people who've had who have been in a position to weigh the costs and benefits of the CIA's existence and have come out thinking that, on balance, national security would be improved if we actually just didn't have a CIA. So that is a perfectly defensible and respectable position. That's one thing. The other thing is, look, at a minimum, if I were advising Sanders today, I would say, at a minimum, you've got to detach the covert action arm from the intelligence gathering and analysis arm. It's just these are two things that inherently don't function well together. But just as the NSA is tasked with, on the one hand, destroying encryption, on the other hand, there's another part of the organization that is tasked ostensibly with improving encryption. You can't put that. It's like putting a humidifier and a dehumidifier in the room and telling them to battle it out. It's just like it doesn't work. You're not going to get good results. And so with the agency, the covert military arm of the agency really should be put in the military. It shouldn't be in a position to interfere with the objectivity of intelligence analysis that our policymakers rely on.
Well, Barry Eisler, I'd like to ask you to stay afterwards so we can continue this conversation. He is author of The God's Eye View. He's a New York Times bestselling author, and he is a former CIA agent. We will continue the conversation after the show and post it at democracynow.org. But when we come back, we're going to talk to a journalist who was just detained. She was detained by the U.S.-backed government in Bahrain. This is her first interview since. Stay with us.
Katrine from Penn State.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show with an exclusive interview with one of four U.S. journalists who were detained in the Gulf state of Bahrain and released Sunday after an international outcry. Anna Therese Day and her camera crew were in Bahrain during protests marking the anniversary of the kingdom's February 2011 uprising. Bahraini authorities accused the group of falsely representing themselves as tourists and claimed one of them participated in an attack on police. They were taken into custody and charged with illegal assembly with the intent to commit a crime. During their interrogation, they were initially denied an attorney and prevented from speaking with family members.
Human Rights First said the arrest of the journalists is part of a continuing crackdown on dissent in Bahrain. This comes as the group renews its call for the release of Bahraini opposition leader Ibrahim Sharif, who was sentenced to a year in jail Wednesday for a 2015 speech in which he called for change. The Bahraini government has fought to suppress opposition protesters and journalists since the 2011 uprising that was crushed by martial law and U.S.-backed forces from Saudi Arabia. Bahrain is a close ally of the United States. It's home to the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet, which is responsible for all naval forces in the Gulf. Well, for more, we're glad to be joined by Anna Therese Day, one of the journalists just released from detention in Bahrain. It's great to have you with us. Talk about when you went to Bahrain and what happened.
We went for the five-year anniversary of their uprising, which was February 14th. One thing that is interesting about Bahrain is, while it's often overlooked, it had one of the highest percentages of its population that participated in its Arab Spring uprising. So we were excited to get back there. I'd reported there in 2011. We wanted to follow up on the reports of human rights violations continuing, and again, human rights violations that continue right next to one of America's most important military presence in the world.
And what happened?
We entered on tourist visas. We were entering.
Why tourist visas?
We were entering undercover. We knew that we would be meeting primarily with opposition figures that face enormous threats inside the country. We made that decision deliberately. understanding the potential consequences, and we decided that we absolutely felt this story was worth the risk. So we entered on tourist visas undercover, met with opposition and activists and protesters leading up to the five-year anniversary, and learned about the tremendous repression that they face to this day.
And when were you detained?
We were detained on the five-year anniversary of the uprising.
So the very day you arrived? Like, how long after you arrived?
We had been in the country for about 3 days. And to even go to the areas that the main protests were, the people have been pushed off the main thoroughfares of Bahrain. So, you know, you can drive down the highway in Bahrain and it seems like a glistening Gulf kingdom. But if you look off the highway, you can see clouds of black smoke in these neighborhoods that have been totally cordoned off. So to even enter the neighborhoods, we had trouble entering them the first few days because they've been totally sealed off from the main highways. To enter the neighborhoods, you have to climb over barbed wire and concrete barriers. The residents have enormous trouble getting in and out. And then inside, because there have been so many midnight raids on these people's neighborhoods and communities, young people have started putting up their own barricades to prevent the police from continuing these midnight roundups. Mm.
So what exactly happened to you?
When we were inside reporting, one of our sound engineer, he was up with one of our camera ops at the front of one of the protests. And while the protesters fled, they did as well, following them. And the police were able to grab our sound engineer. Then we immediately called the embassy, said that, you know, he's at a police station now. We have his passport. We're very worried about that. But that this neighborhood it was a little war zone. It was totally sealed off. And if we walked over to the police station, we'd be arrested as well. The embassy said they would intervene. And they also advised us to stay in the neighborhood for the night because they are very well aware of the crackdown on these neighborhoods and that there's essentially an occupation. So we were planning on staying inside. We continued to do some reporting. However, as the evening went on, of course, we were very concerned about our colleague. We were also very concerned about the material and the safety of people we'd shot. And then lastly, protesters started taking pictures of us and tweeting them because they were so excited to have foreign journalists. And we realized, you know, that could endanger the people that we were staying with inside. So we wanted to leave so that the nighttime raids on these neighborhoods wouldn't turn into, you know, an aggressive search for the foreign journalists.
And 5 years, you went 5 years after the protests began. What did you learn from the people that you were able to speak to in those 3 days? You said Bahrain had the largest proportion of the population participating in the protests. What's happened in the intervening 5 years?
The government has succeeded in creating, an oppressive culture of fear. The protesters, although they're not able to make it to the main thoroughfares, they're still protesting in their neighborhoods. Just to describe the scene a little bit for you guys, on the 14th, the police occupied the neighborhood so aggressively that the people couldn't even fully congregate. So the whole day was spent people trying to come to mosques and main areas where they could congregate, and the police, you know, busting through these areas, arresting people, rounding people up. The rooftops of these entire neighborhoods were filled with family members, so grandmothers, grandfathers, parents shouting from the rooftops, the police are coming from that way, just shouting directions down to the young people trying to protest. Another important thing that we noticed was when the protesters would run from the police, they were brought into strangers' homes. We were brought into other people's homes. Grandmothers were, you know, giving us water and trying to feed us. It felt like a neighborhood effort to continue to resist this police occupation.
Ultimately, how long were you held for?
48 hours.
And how did you get out?
Embassy intervention, absolutely. We were prevented from calling our embassy repeatedly. We were isolated, detained, mistreated, deprived of.
Interrogated during this time?
Yes.
We're going to do part two of this conversation and post it online at democracynow.org. Anna Therese Day, independent journalist who's lived and reported in the Middle East for 5 years, focusing on how U.S. foreign policy affects young people in the region. She was just recently detained by the Bahraini government with her camera crew. And we will continue the conversation at democracynow.org.
org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We have 3 job openings at Democracy Now! Check our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guster. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.